this week's In Your Frame podcast, we welcome Scott Guthrie, influencer marketing advisor from the UK and also host of the podcast, The Influencer Marketing Lab, which is a weekly podcast which charts the growth spurts and growing pains of influencer marketing. Each week, he shares conversations with topic experts about the influencer marketing industry, the business, the tech, the key themes, and the media coverage. Welcome to the Enco podcast, Scott Guthrie.
Well, hello, and thank you very much, Patrick, for inviting me on. I'm a great fan of this. I listened to a few of your other episodes, particularly like the one with Dominic Smales. He's a past guest on the Influencer Marketing Lab, and lots to say on where the industry has come from and where it's going to. So thank you very much for having me on your show today.
No, it's great to have you on, and thank you for referencing our previous podcast. The reason we wanted to have you on the discussion today was to talk about our two markets, the UK and Australia. And of course, one of the key themes we will probably end up discussing is ad disclosure. But I thought before we even started, it would be worth saying that we should be disclosing something about yourself, which is you do have a bit of an Aussie connection.
I do. And I'm very proud of that Aussie connection. I'm a proud carrier of dual nationality, the two passports. I've got an Australian dad. He worked at a Sydney advertising agency before moving over to London in 1963, if you can believe it. So I'm ostensibly English. I grew up in England. I toyed with the idea of settling in Sydney around 2001, 2002. And I flew over a few times with that goal in mind. Clive Marshall had been appointed recently as the chief executive at AAP, and I'd worked with Clive whilst he was the commercial director at the Press Association, the UK's national news agency. But ultimately, I stayed in London. My employer at the time kept offering me small crumbs in the way of promotions, and then they put me through an MBA. So I'll be eternally grateful to them. But in 2013, as we said in the preamble, Patrick, I moved with my doing life partner, Patricia, and our two small kids to Erskineville for a couple of years. And I worked with John Kroll at Isentia for a while whilst I was there. So, yeah, I'm proud of the heritage. And I have fairly recent working knowledge of the two geographical areas. And not least, I've worked with one of your founding members, Q83, especially Anthony Richardson, working on their launch of Q83 in the UK and Australian markets.
So a bit of a foot in both camps and both markets and countries. So I'd love to ask you then, what's your view from the UK of what the influencer marketing market is like over here?
There's a lot going on. And it's a particularly exciting time for influencer marketing. What's happening in the UK? I think the UK Parliament is starting to roll up its sleeves and look at two related areas simultaneously. It's looking at big tech and its level of oligarchic power, and it's looking increasingly at influencer culture. There is a select committee that is just putting together written evidence about influencer culture at the moment. So watch this space on both of those items. I know that in Australia, you've had your digital platforms inquiry and the ACCC and Facebook and Google, that's rumbling on. In terms of influencer marketing developments, I think there are three main pushes. There's e-commerce and moving into social commerce, and that's been accelerated by the global pandemic induced by COVID-19. I think there's an increasing embracing of live stream commerce, that QVCification of influencer marketing. And I think we need to devote a lot more of our time and consideration towards diversity, inclusion, and representation. And that means not just paying lip service, but building the importance of this into your brand's DNA, being part of who you are. So this week on my podcast, The Influencer Marketing Lab, I'm in conversation with Imogen Coles, Influence Program Director at Ogilvy. And she talks, for example, about diversity starting with diversity of thought. This means representation starting in the influencer marketing agency workforce and then moving out. So it's not just about paying creators equally. It's not just about having different color faces on your influencer marketing campaigns, but it's about removing that unconscious bias from the production that your agency is putting forward.
There's something you touched upon there. It's something that I read and saw recently, that they, given the drive of e-commerce and so on, it kind of said that the influencers are moving into now becoming the new retailers. Is that something that you're starting to see as well?
Yeah, 100%. So, I think this is a big trend to embrace, but also to watch out for in terms of brands, because I think increasingly brands have sought to go direct to customers or direct to consumers, and influencers are increasingly doing the same. And we've seen that from the mega influencers from years ago, you know, Emily Weiss, the creator of Glossy, you know, that she moved into that sort of 4 or 5 years ago, and her whole makeup product range has been produced with the assistance of influencer marketing and tapping into her audience for creative ideas, and so sort of a focus group on steroids. And we've seen that with the Kardashians as well. But now we're seeing sort of the mid-tier moving into direct-to-consumer products, and they're going direct to retailers. So if you look at, for example, I can't remember his last name, but Ryan's World, that nine-year-old kid, he was Forbes's number one influencer in terms of brand collaborations last year. But that the revenue is dwarfed when you consider the amount of money that was earned through white labeling goods in terms of toys and toothbrushes under the banner of Ryan's World's products. So we're seeing this blurring of an influencer as sort of a, you know, renting out their audience. Increasingly, you're seeing an influencer moving from renting out their community to a brand, to actually harnessing and commercializing their own community and working with brands, not necessarily as sort of brand partners, but more as sort of blurring that line and being part owner of products.
And that diversification of that young man that's clearly making money outside of brand partnerships, he's clearly then making opportunities through creating, I guess, products with brands and utilising his IP. And then Dominic Smales also spoke about a change or a movement now for diversification of influencers moving into a subscription-based model, so not overly then reliant on brand-funded deals.
And I think, you know, I think influencers have felt as if they've been sort of stung in the past, and once bitten, you know, twice shy goes the cliche. And they've moving away from being completely dependent on one platform. So they might spread their risk from Instagram to TikTok, for example, because they want to get away from the vagaries of the algorithm. They might be moving away from solely being dependent on YouTube and AdSense revenue, for example, as well. But they also want to make sure that they can isolate themselves from being in and out of favor with brands and brand collaborations. So, you know, true influencers are influential by definition, because they have nurtured a community around them, and they're looking to tap into that community themselves.
And let's then touch upon something that the UK is certainly ahead of the Australian market in, and that comes to ad disclosure, which is a really big topic at the moment, given the SBS documentary that we recently had come out, and some high profile cases recently. The AANA's code of ethics had been breached through Anna Hendrick and Rosalia's posts recently. Now, yeah, Zoella, for example, was quite a high profile case, I think, last year. What was learned, and what was the impact of that in the UK market?
So there are a couple of things. The CMA is the Competitions and Markets Authority, and they wrote to, I think, 16 influencers, but that was 2 years ago, I think, saying that they hadn't properly complied with advertising disclosure regulations. That surprised me a little bit about Zoella, because I think, you know, she's been in the game a long time, and B, I think she does her best. So possibly that suggests that the guidelines are shifting, or the way we treat the guidelines is shifting by the regulators. But I think it's a movable feast, and I think it's incumbent on us as practitioners to work closer with regulators and with big tech companies to make sure that the consumer is protected, just as we are trying to make sure that the advertisers are protected as well.
And I suppose with the Zoella thing, you were surprised there, but it was probably a thought that if you get a high-profile person having breached something like this, it will have a wider impact with influencers that perhaps wouldn't expect that if this person gets caught out, that I would get caught out too.
So, you know, if you look at the sanctions at the disposal of the ASA and the CMA, that they start off with trying to shame the influencer. And so if you're better off going after a big ticket name so that brings notoriety, and the Daily Mail or the Mail Online will run a story about it. It's usually either a well-known influencer or a reality TV star is usually up in lights for the shock horror that they haven't, you know, been abiding by the ad regulation. There was a report undertaken in March by the Advertising Standards Authority, and they looked into 122 Instagram accounts to see who was tracking, who was effectively disclosing ad disclosures. And they found that out of 24,000 bits of content, only something like 35% was effectively disclosed. Now, I mentioned this because the 122 parties in the report weren't randomly selected. These were already Instagram accounts or influencers that had been brought to the attention of the ASA. So what this tells me is that there's a minority of influencers who are aware of the rules and choose to, for whatever reason, presumably through a commercial decision, they've made a decision not to abide by those rules. So I think, back to your point, the regulators look for a big ticket name to try and create publicity. But I also think regulators need to look at their own sanctions at their disposal to see, you know, what happens to repeat offenders. And should they also just get a slap on the wrist, or should there be a ladder of sanctions that prevent them from reoffending?
And you talk about journalism and it being reported in some of the newspapers and online media. We, as I referenced earlier, we recently had an SBS documentary that talked about the ins and outs of influencer marketing and trying to get undercover to understand the fakeness or exposing this space around its practices. You've seen the SBS documentary. I wonder what your thoughts were on that.
Well, I saw the first episode, and it's great telly. that's part of the problem, but it shows you sort of an old style world of what influencers are and what influencer marketing is. And it's sort of bound up or overly excited about vanity metrics. And the industry has moved forward. It's moved away from calculating on likes and reach, or certainly theoretical reach and numbers of engagement. And we're looking more towards metrics and ultimately impact metrics. And that's why I fully commend the work that AIMCO is doing at making sure that other brands are aware and consumers are aware of best practice. Because if you work with an influencer and set up a proper objectives, you'll be measuring things beyond whether that person got, you know, 100 likes or 50 comments or something. You want to know, who has actually bought the product ultimately. And with that in mind, it's a moot point about influencer fraud or a journalist posing as an influencer, because ideally we're measuring things beyond vanity metrics. There was a case in the US, I think, at the beginning of the year, that Nick Bilson, I think it was that they did a very similar style of documentary. But it shows me an old school view of influencer marketing. And I think that there is a case for mainstream media being sort of boo-hiss when it comes to influencer marketing. And partly that is because I think if you scroll back, and I talked about this with Dom, that if you scroll back 5 years, a lot of the column entries, the sentiment was positive about influencer marketing. You get that tall poppy syndrome that the industry has built up influencer marketing and now wants to knock it down. And I think there are a few bad actors within the space that bring bad notoriety to the industry. And I think there's also a conflation between what we talk about influence and what we talk about reality TV stars, suddenly with a big Instagram following. But also, I think there's a disincentive often for mainstream media to eulogise about influencer marketing, because increasingly mainstream media or legacy media or traditional media is vying for the same ad spend as influencer marketing spend. So, you know, it's not in their best interest to say what another wonderful story about influencer there is.
Yes, it certainly did feel like a piece that was put together that when the social network stuff kind of came out with the Netflix, or Fyre Festival, you started having wider conversations that people that don't work in marketing or don't really understand social media and starting asking questions like, is this true? Does this really happen? It was just perhaps a way of helping to explain to the wider audience what it was. But those in the industry are probably looking at it with a view, as you have shared there, of something of an old world view on the industry.
But that's because, Patrick, we live and breathe it. You know, all of my all of my working hours are devoted to influencer marketing. So the casual consumer isn't that way. But that's why I think it's almost a godsend, this SBS show for AIMCO, because it has widened that conversation, and it's differentiating the good guys from the bad guys. You know, in 2015, globally, there are 190 influencer marketing agencies and platforms, 190 in 2015. Today, there are 1,360. So it's inevitable that you're going to get some bad actors as well as some good guys. And that's what the AIMCO is showing. You know, we're the good guys. You can trust us. And we're pushing forward progressive best practice within the industry.
It's good to be one of the good guys. And I just wanted to end with that view. I know that you've been a very big supporter of the work that we've been doing with AIMCO and supportive of the code of practice and so on. I just wanted to get overall your view from an outsider's perspective on the work that we're trying to do and trying to deliver in this marketplace. What is it that encourages you about the journey we're on?
Well, I was thrilled and a little bit surprised to get an email from Jasan, Ryan and Heather Craven back in July 2019 saying they've been asked to set up this thing, but they didn't quite know what this thing was. And, you know, and then we had a chat and we've had various calls and email threads throughout the time. So I think there's an enormous amount of work that has been put in to this offering. You know, even I think 6 months ago, you didn't even have a website, but you had this code of conduct, this code of product, this code of ethics and code of practice, and it's nudging the industry forward. So whenever there is a documentary such as SBS or whatever, the Daily Telly runs a negative story about Married at First Sight contestant, for example, You can rest on the authority of AIMCO to correct those misgivings within the industry. And also, I think increasingly, when big tech globally is under the microscope, I think AIMCO will increasingly be in a position to work with the consumer, but work with the regulators and work with big tech to make sure that the consumer and advertisers are equally protected. I have a lot of time and respect for the work that AIMCO is doing.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. We really appreciate you coming on. And of course, with your experience in both the UK and Australia, when the global markets open up, we'd love to have you over here at some point to welcome you into AIMCO, and we can all meet face-to-face with our members and the industry here.
I'll hold you to that, Patrick. Maybe there's a schooner in it for me too.
Thank you again, Scott. So thank you for listening. If you're interested in finding out more about the Australian Influencer Marketing Council, please visit our website, aimco.org.au, where we're trying to build confidence and trust in influencer marketing. Thank you for listening.